Well, this is the interactive portion of the program. We will take your calls with Nigel Watson as we talk about alien abductions. Jump on board with stories or questions. And welcome back, George Norrie, along with Nigel Watson. Nigel, before we get to calls, what do you think of the November 5th, 1975 Travis Walton case?
That's a pretty tricky one, really, because that's one of the rare cases where somebody's disappeared for literally days instead of just a few minutes or hours. So I think it's still quite a controversial case, but his fellow loggers actually say the saw him sort of zapped on board a flying saucer. And, I think you mentioned before lie detectors. And
that's right.
These have been used on Travis and the witnesses.
And they all passed, all of them.
Yeah. But, it's knowing where Travis went to in those missing days. Fire in the Sky is a sort of brilliant film about it because it kind of looks at the skepticism of the local authorities, and I think the police were almost treating it like a murder case because he'd gone missing. And I think the film looks at it from a kind of from different angles as well. So I think that it's one of the better films about, a real UFO encounter. Travis has always stuck to his story. But there has been debate about whether, he's just exploiting the subject or anything. But, his testimony looks quite solid, really. And, there again, we're back to trying to find any positive evidence. I think, Betty Hill was aware of that and tried taking a book away from a flying saucer, but nobody's ever really been able to take anything from a flying saucer to prove, that it's something extraterrestrial. And, that's very much like the stories of people going into fairyland. They take, say, a gold necklace or some evidence, but when they come back to reality, it turns out to be a handful of grass or, something that's just totally mundane. And, that's another frustrating thing, that you'd think somebody would be able to actually take something from a source of craft. I think that's another landmark case, but it kind of came out just after the UFO incident TV movie about the Hill case came out. So you don't know whether, they might have seen that film and kind of it might have given Travis some ideas about, being abducted by aliens or anything.
I believe the guy. I've talked to him several times. I've met him many times.
Yeah.
I believe him. Well, something happened to him.
Yeah, there's been kind of dispute, but people have kind of stuck behind the story. And, if you see him in interviews, he looks pretty convincing. And it's like a lot of abduction cases, really. It's hard to really pin down what really happened. I think there are some cases where people have had sleep paralysis and that
mm-hmm.
sort of experience.
Sure.
But, obviously with him being sort of zapped aboard a flying saucer in the middle of the woods with witnesses, doesn't really make sleep paralysis any sense in that case.
Why don't the Brits rely on hypnosis?
I think it's just that the feel that just the process of hypnosis is, in relation to a UFO case has already set the scenario for that. And the feel that, people might give leading questions. And it's never really been something ufologists have really employed. It's quite interesting, though, if you look at an American cases, even back in the 70s, ufologists were actually hypnotizing people themselves. I think with the Pascrola case, I think there was an attempt to hypnotize them quite early on. And I think John Keel actually hypnotized people, and obviously Bud Hopkins did. But it's nothing British ufologists have really embraced. Like I said, Tony Dodd did use a friendly hypnotist to regress his witnesses. But generally, you know, if ufologists in Britain have used hypnosis, it's through not doing it themselves. But it's never really been well supported by British ufologists. And I think the British UFO Research Association did a list of ethics, and they felt it wasn't ethical to hypnotise people. I think it's also worth pointing out with the Hill case, they were actually hypnotised for therapeutic reasons. Dr. Simons didn't want to, he wasn't investigating a UFO case, he was trying to sort out, you know, Barney's health and stress related issues. And so, in a way, that was more justifiable. And in a way, the abduction case sort of popped out as a kind of side product of that. So, I think in that sense, I think hypnosis could be good for therapeutic reasons, but perhaps it depends on the witness. Some people want to be hypnotized and find out more, and I think, you know, that's fair enough. But I think sometimes it might stir up more than people can handle, and, you know, I think it's something you should tread carefully with and not be too gung-ho about it.
Are you familiar with the Australian case from 1978, Frederick Valentich, where his plane simply disappeared and he was... He was last heard saying something, I'm approaching something, and then poof, he's gone.
Yeah, that was an intriguing case. I think that was sort of late 70s, I think, and there seemed to be an outcrop of cases like that. And there was quite a few sort of pilot encounters like that where people have disappeared in aircraft, but with that one, it was actually recorded by ground control. And he was also interested in UFOs, and his plane just sort of disappeared at night time.
His last words, his transmission, it's not an aircraft.
Yeah.
That's intriguing, isn't it?
Yeah. It makes you wonder. And it's something, I think there's an image in one of the classic 50s movies where there's an aircraft full of scientists and they get swallowed up by a UFO. And I think Donald Keyhoe mentions some case of an aircraft merging with a UFO radar blip or something and it disappears. So this is another element of ufology that you don't really get much of. That was a rare example. And, you know, we don't seem to get cases like that anymore.
Let's take some calls here for you. Let's start by going east of the Rockies. Jose's with us, truck driving in Texas. Hello, Jose.
Hi. First of all, thank you for taking my call.
Sure, thank you.
I have two questions on the abduction. Do you think maybe if they have hybrids already throughout, they communicate with them already and not take more people? And my second question is, when I was in second grade, there was a UFO landing on Franklin Mountain, and it came out in the news. And from where we lived, you could see that they were turning people away because people were trying to get up to the mountain. And you could see where the police was making them turn around, and you could see the car headlights shine on the mountain as they were being forced to come back down.
And so, what's your question there, Jose?
Is there a way to find out how? I've tried Google, that episode, but I don't find anything on that.
What year would that have been, do you think?
It was the year President Kennedy was shot, so it must have been 63, because I was in second grade.
Yeah, she was shot in 63. Have you ever heard of that case, Franklin Mountain case?
No, I've...
I have not.
I've just Googled it, actually, and it said there was one spotted over Franklin Mountains.
1963?
No, this is 2019.
Ah, okay.
It said... on sort of, what was this?
His other question was about hybridization.
December 2019, and they said a sort of UFO. It sounds like it's one of these sort of UFO hotspots, really, where UFOs tend to sort of lurk around certain areas. So, and I think mountain areas are very kind of popular with UFO activity.
And hybrids are supposed to be part human, part ET, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Interesting.
I think the thing with hybrids, though, is that the problem is abductees, like the ones Bud Hopkins talked to, is that the, you know, you had this whole thing about missing fetus syndrome, where women would be pregnant and then
gone.
A few months later, the fetus will have disappeared. And then later, sometimes introduced to the child on board a flying saucer during, you know, another abduction. And, you know, you know, hybrid children as such are never sort of can never be met on Earth, if you know what I mean. You know, we're mm-hmm. taken away. And... yeah, I have come across one or two British cases of missing fetus syndrome as well. And, you know, it's hard to explain that as well. I think Mary Rodwell she's in Australia. She's sort of been a bit of a specialist on that subject as well.
You mentioned David Jacobs earlier, and he doesn't believe these visitations are friendly at all.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, this has come up with UAP cases as well, where they're regarded as a sort of alien threat. And one of the earliest books I ever read was UFOs Are Hostile. And that really scared me because cases of UFOs burning people and taking them away. And, you know, obviously with... later on, there's people talking about cattle mutilations and different things. And there is that fear of what UFOs might do, and lots of these accounts of sinister activities. But it's quite interesting, even in Spielberg's Close Encounters of the Third Kind, the aliens seem to be very threatening and frightening, the chase police cars and that sort of thing, and take away the child from the woods at night, and yet the benevolent at the end sort of thing. So perhaps it's the fact that we don't understand their motivations. And, you know, I think some people explain the fact that people were burnt because it got too close to the propulsion systems of a flying saucer. But and there's also a classic Canadian case where a man... got really close to a flying saucer and had a burnt grid pattern on his chest. And that was quite thoroughly...
like radiation or something, huh?
Yeah, or, you know, a kind of severe burn. Well,
that's what happened at Rendlesham to some people, too.
Yeah.
Jim Peniston.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. I think somebody took a case against the Army, didn't he, or something? And
yes.
Won a payout over that. So there have been quite a few cases where people have been physically burnt or something. But I think also you have to take into account that people are also psychologically traumatized. And that's another thing about abductees, that, you know, perhaps that's why they often don't want to talk about it, because, you know, people will think they're crazy. And I think, you know, that's a sad thing, really. I think, you know, people have made Facebook groups or talked about their experiences on Facebook, and then, you know, people have kind of shot them down. And I think the thing is, you know, whatever your beliefs are, whether you think it's fantasy or not, I don't think that's a good way to treat people. And if you, you know, there are people who have experienced all sorts of really weird things that don't seem to be, you know, beyond the realms of reality. But I think it's worth, you know, there's still a person, and you've got to sort of understand, you know, their viewpoint of what's going on with them.
Well, I used to say to myself, Nigel, you know, we're 4.5 billion years old. The universe is 13.5 billion years old. Somewhere along the line, there are other planetary systems that are billions of years older than us. It's entirely possible they've developed technologies with their own life forces, and they're, you know, traveling the universe.
Yeah, I think even some astronomers have made theories about this. And like you say, we're quite young compared to the age of the universe, and that, you know, some intelligent species who's sort of billions of years old, you know, you can't imagine how advanced they'd be, really. You know, technology might be just something that kids play with, you know. It's amazing how far we've come in, say, the last 100 years. So, you know, if you sort of multiply that by millions of years, who knows what can happen. And I think even astronomers have looked at how civilizations could harness the power of black holes to generate sort of time travel and to colonize an old galaxy. But, you know, when you look at astronomy and just the vast scale of the universe, it's just amazing. And if you think that there could even be entities that could perhaps, you know, live for thousands of years, then, you know, for them, you know, to survey planet Earth in, say, the last 60 years, is just a blink into, you know, it's amazing what I think the old subject of ufology is, that it does make you wonder about our place in the universe and the, you know, what might be going on out there.
It's fascinating, though, isn't it, Nigel?
Yeah, and, you know, I think to speak to people, you know, even if you're a skeptic, I think, in a way, you kind of want to believe in these things. So, but, you know, I think with me, I've got a kind of skeptical side, so I'm sort of like pro and con, really. So I think I once described myself as a sort of optimistic skeptic, you know. So, but you know, I think it's easy to have some abstract explanation, but it's really hard to get a blanket explanation for everything.
Indeed. Nigel, we're going to come back and take final calls with you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, why are people so miserable? We're going to talk a little bit about that, and then Christy Robinette joins us to talk about night terrors and nightmares on Coast to Coast. Make sure you're part of the program. And welcome back. Nigel Watson with us, our final segment. Let's go right to the calls. Brendan in Austin, Texas. Hey, Brendan, go ahead.
Hey, thanks so much, George and Nigel. So I noticed that you guys earlier were talking about the paranormal in general, and I kind of wanted to hop on board of that. And I noticed that whether it's ETs, Bigfoot, ghosts, Nigel had kind of mentioned, and I've experienced the same thing, that they're always one step ahead, it feels like. You're always trying to catch up with them, and that anytime they let you get evidence, it's just that, them letting you get evidence, because your equipment will break down. It's really hard to get any sort of these experiences. So I had gone to the San Antonio Paranormal Festival and had a lot of fun there at the Black Swan Inn, and there was a medium that was using a spirit box there. It was apparently a really rare type of spirit box, and he had voices coming through, and it seemed like it was a good connection. So I wanted to have a challenging question. And he kept on talking to somebody called the technicians. And so I asked about the pandemic, whether it was man-made or not, and these voices came through and said that it was man-made. So that kind of gave me the idea of connecting to higher, hyper-intelligent beings, maybe ETs, with EVPs, the electronic voice phenomenon work, and using that to try to help humanity. And do you think that's a good idea or anything like that? Thank you.
Not a bad idea at all. What do you think, Nigel?
Yeah, I think there's quite a crossover, really. I think somebody called George Hunt Williamson, who was a mate of George Adamski, used a Ouija board to connect with alien entities. And there's another book, Briefing for a Landing, I think it's called Briefing for a Landing on Earth, or something like that, that came out sort of late 70s. And that was a group of psychics. I think Yuri Geller might have been involved at some stage. And they were having sort of different sort of psychic communications with aliens. And they were felt that these communications were helping to stop war in the Middle East. And they think, you know, they might have succeeded in sort of trying to stop too much warfare over there. So people have tried using different psychic phenomenon to not just connect with sort of dead spirits, but with aliens. And, you know, it's quite interesting, though, that, you know, there's a kind of crossover there, that people, things have vectored into, like, space-age ideas, whereas in the past, you know, you've got messages from people, you know, famous figures from history or, you know, dead relatives or something. So it's kind of interesting that psychic phenomenon also can go through different fashions, I suppose, you might call it. And because we're interested in space exploration now, you know, that things we might contact take on that image. But I think people like John Keel said it could be something like ultra-terrestrials that might be actually living almost in a parallel plane with Earth, you know, that they could actually be just manifestations of our own planet, and they take on forms that we can easily accommodate. So in the past, we'd see ghosts and spirits, whereas now, you know, we're more likely to see sort of aliens, really. So I think, you know, it's something that's been part of ufology, but I suppose it's been part more of the, you know, the fringes and the contactee area of it.
Were you disappointed, Nigel, in the United States' report that came out on June 25th?
I wasn't really disappointed because I didn't get my hopes up, really. I think a lot of people got excited by it, and, you know, quite a lot of different reports had come out beforehand, and all these, you know, videos by aircraft pilots. But I think the thing with the OU thing and the release by the government of this document is the fact that we've just gone back to square one, really, because this is exactly the position the United States Air Force was faced with back in the early 1950s. You know, there was a great wave of sightings over Washington in, I think, 1952, which really frightened the authorities. And they, you know, got together groups and reports, and then Project Blue Book came about. But we all become a bit mealy-mouthed at first to think they're going to try and track down the subject, and then nothing really transpires. I think a classic example was something called Project Twinkle that was set up in the sort of early 1950s in sort of New Mexico, because there'd been loads of sightings of green fireballs. And because we're seen near Air Force bases and everything, they had a project to try and film them, but it just remained really inconclusive, because wherever the cameras were, the green fireballs were elsewhere. And sorry, and I think that's another thing. At the moment, a lot of people are trying to develop different types of UFO tracking systems. Some are commercially available, where you get a sort of camera system and it mm-hmm. try and track anything unusual in the sky. But when you think of the immensity of a planet and, you know, the chances of picking something up are quite slim, really. And obviously with Project Twinkle, we just didn't have the resources to track down any green fireballs. And in the end, it kind of just disappeared. But it's still quite an intriguing phenomenon, and green fireballs still turn up now and again. So I think that's a real problem with this UAP thing. I don't know whether the government has kind of got the resources to really investigate them properly.
And if they do, will they tell us? Let's go to Guy in Michigan, first-time caller. Hi, Guy. Go ahead.
Hi, George. How are you?
Thank you.
Kind of a wreck. I was nervous about calling. I'm an old man, and I've been sitting on this for a long time. You're from Michigan, I believe, aren't you?
Yep, born in Detroit.
I don't know if you ever knew Shirley Coyne, but...
I did not.
The MUFON director here in Michigan for a lot of years, and... Back in 94, this is kind of a general question for you and Nigel.
Okay.
I've just never heard of anything like this. March of 94, there were a bunch of UFOs seen over on the west side of the state, and I lived in Flint. And I thought they were just over there. And I was driving to work at 5 in the morning on US 23, driving from Flint to Brighton. I came around a curve, and there was this huge triangular craft. Well, it was at least 200 feet by 200 feet by 200 feet, and it was almost on the ground. And I get stressed talking about it. And it had, you know, these brilliant white lights that didn't throw headlights. I ended up being about 100 foot from it. And two of my coworkers showed up an hour late for work. One was my best friend. And I had to counsel her for a week. She's a black lady, hardcore Southern Baptist. And
did they see it too?
What's that?
Did they see it too?
That's the crazy part. She said, "Guy," she said, "you know, when you and some other people in the lunchroom were talking about that UFO, me and Felicia, we didn't see anything."
Huh?
She said, "We were driving along. We thought we had black ice, and Felicia was asleep." She said, "Guy, my van." What happened was it happened on a Friday, and on Monday she came running up to me and said, "Call me when you get home." I called her up. I didn't know what she wanted. I'd made a report to this MUFON outfit because I called the airport, and this guy told me about it. And I'd given them a report, but Carolyn came running up to me and said, "You got to call me after work, Guy. You got to call me after work." And I didn't really know her all that well. And she was my only friend at work, and I called her, you know, thinking maybe she had a family problem. And, I was really, really close to this thing. I mean, I could hit it with a rock, and it was big.
How did it disappear? How did it leave?
Oh, man, are you kidding? I slowed way down when I went under it, and it had this orangish-red light that was illuminating, and it had kind of a striated bottom. And I floored the car and went about 1,000 yards and looked back.
And it was gone.
And that orange light was lighting up the tops of the trees, man. And I just floored the car. I drove to Fenton, Michigan. I got off the freeway, ran into a convenience store, and I screaming.
Well, I got to tell you, that episode happened 3 years before the Phoenix Lights, where a lot of people describe seeing that object that you just described. Is it conceivable, Nigel, that he was looking at the same thing, but 3 years earlier?
Yeah, and also at that period, triangular crafts were all the rage. In Britain, a lot of these triangular craft were seen over Dudley, which is in the Midlands of England, and we call them Dudley Doritos. Doritos are a sort of triangular-shaped snack, and you know, were quite often seen in the 90s, really. And like you say, the Phoenix Lights episode is a reflection of this thing that was also seen. I think it's also that people often see these things at night from their cars, and, you know, seeing something in the sky from a car isn't a brilliant observation point, is it? You know, because you're obviously having to try and concentrate on the road as well. But, you know, this one sounds really intriguing because it was so close to him. And I think there's also a theory that some people are attuned to seeing a UFO in the sky, and like another motorist might not see them. I think there's been cases where somebody's been in a car and seen a UFO, and the other occupants haven't seen the UFO.
They see nothing. That's weird, though, isn't it?
Yeah. I think Bud Hopkins also said that there's a sort of like people are switched on and off, where when somebody's abducted, the other people seem to be in suspended animation, you know, and they've been kind of switched off and aren't aware of what's going on, whereas the abductee does eventually find out what happens through hypnosis or through dreams or something. And, you know, I think... It shows again, like now, people are talking about tic-tac craft. So it's almost like they go through different fashions that, you know, people saw phantom airships, you know, way back at the turn of the turn of the last century. And, you know, the kind of shape to how we expect to see strange objects, really.
If you had to make a bet... If you had to bet a lot of wager money, would you say the UFO phenomenon is real or imagination?
I'd say it has a real impact on our lives, but I think it's a high amount of imagination as well. It's difficult because there's so many explanations. I once was driving through Wiltshire near Warminster, which was a UFO hotspot, and there were several of us in the car, and we stopped the car because we saw a light in the distant fields, and then several more lights appeared, and it looked like this like mothership from Close Encounters. It wasn't until it got really close that we could hear its motors, and it was one of these advertising blimps. But if it hadn't come closer, you know, we would have been convinced it was a, you know, classic flying saucer. And two or three other cars stopped behind us as well. And it was quite eerie seeing this object. So even though it did, at the end, have an explanation, it was quite, you know, quite a profound experience to see these lights. And
pretty dramatic indeed. Nigel, we're out of time, my friend. Keep in touch with us. His latest work, Captured by Aliens. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Lattasor, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burrows, Tim Banal, George Knapp, and Ian Punnett, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.